I tried to model it both on what my parents did and what I do with Jessa when she comes home and then she's had a bad day or whatever. We try to talk about it. It's not a punishment. I want to know what caused it. What can we do to make sure it doesn't happen again? What can we do to fix it?
Welcome to the ADHD Essentials Podcast. I'm your host, Brendan Mahan. I'm an ADHD professional who has been working in the field for 10 years. I'm on the organizing committee for the International Conference on ADHD and a board member of the Men's ADHD Support Group. Registration for the 2024 session of the ADHD Essentials Parenting Groups is now open. This round begins May 6th. We meet for 1 hour, twice a week, on Mondays and Wednesdays over the course of 8 weeks. One section is at 12 p.m. Eastern and the other is at 5 p.m. The 12 p.m. Eastern section is exclusive to parents of teens, but the 5 p.m. section will be open to all. You can learn more about the groups at adhdessentials.com/parentgroups or check out the link in the show notes. I also want to let you know that I am going live in the ADHD Essentials Facebook group regularly at 11 a.m. Eastern on Fridays. This week's topic will be how to get our teens to eat a wider variety of foods. Welcome to the show. In today's episode, we talk to Peter Shankman. Peter is an entrepreneur, a keynote speaker, the best-selling author of 6 books, founder of the neurodiversity consultancy firm Mental Capital, and he's a dad. Peter talks to us about parenting, the power of getting out of our own element in order to get work done, his recent children's book, The Boy with the Faster Brain, and why ADHDers have to learn how to use the faster brain that they have rather than try to use the neurotypical brain that they don't have. He also might have the dog with the best timing in the whole world, but you'll have to listen to the show to find out why. All right, let's get rolling.
Sure, my name is Peter Shankman. I do several things. I'm a born and raised New York City kid with a 10-year-old daughter named Jessa. I am an entrepreneur. I've started and sold 3 companies, most notably Help a Reporter Out or Harrow. I'm a 6-time author, 5-time bestselling author. I run a consultancy firm called Mental Capital, where along with my partner, Dr. Jennifer Hartstein, we teach companies how to attract, hire, and retain neurodiverse employees while helping them create neuro-inclusive workforces. I am a 2-time Ironman. I'm a licensed skydiver. I give a lot of keynotes, so spend a lot of time on planes. And always trying to lose those last 20 pounds.
Usually when people see the name Peter Shankman, they're expecting like the business side of Peter Shankman. I want to talk about Peter Shankman, the dad, and Peter Shankman, kind of the person, if that's okay.
By all means.
When I read Faster Than Normal, you have the rules that you live by, right? Those 4 rules of eliminating unnecessary decisions, exercising daily, eating healthy, especially with protein and chicken in particular, and then being engaged with the world and with your life and that kind of stuff. As I was reading it, part of me, and this is, I'm very much a people pleaser, and I'm sure there's my own bias hiding in this question, but part of me was like, that's really rigid. Like, how does that affect the people around you? And how does that affect, like, as a dad, how do those rules affect being a dad? If you're up at 4 o'clock in the morning riding a bike and your daughter's hanging out, is she like waking up and coming to hang out with you and riding the bike too? Is she sleeping through it? Does this make sense? It
makes perfect sense. I mean, the reason I get up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning is so I can exercise and be better before she wakes up. I put her down around 8:15, 8:30, which means I'm asleep around 8:45, 9 o'clock. And I'm up by around 3:30, 4 o'clock. What that means is that I get 2 hours, 2.5 hours sometimes, to exercise, to get my brain right, to do what I need to do before she wakes up and I start my day. And the nice thing about that is that it allows me to be a better dad, a better person, a better human on the days I don't do it. I mean, I remember she was like 4 years old. It's probably like 6 years ago now. She was 4 years old. And I skipped the bike one day and it was like Saturday morning. I wanted to sleep in. And we're having breakfast. She goes, Daddy, did you get on your bicycle today? I said, no, honey, I was tired. I slept in. She goes, you're not as happy. Blown away by that. So yeah, so she is very aware. And she now calls it, if I don't go, she's like, you didn't get your bike, did you? I'm like, no. I'm like, why? She goes, short talk. I'm like, what's short talk? She goes, you answer questions in a short tone. Like, what do you want for dinner tonight, Jess? I don't know. What can we have? You pick. As opposed to, well, I can make this, or I can make that, or I can make this. You know, so she definitely gets it. But I mean, the bigger picture is how I feel, right? On the days that I exercise. And so We had a beat down town. I was getting her global entry interview this morning because we're flying next month overseas, and I don't want to, it's either get her global entry so she has it like I do, or I leave her at customs and just give her $50 and say, I'll meet you at home. But so we had the interview. We had to be down there at 7:45. And so I was going to cut it close by working out at 4:35 o'clock. So I didn't. So I got up regular time, early, but I didn't work out. I got a little work done, whatever. I knew that I had this interview and another interview after this, and I wanted to be awake for it and in my best zone. So I said, okay, we're taking the subway down all the way downtown for the interview. It's down in Bowling Green and we're up in Hell's Kitchen. I said, but we're walking home. I said, well, we're walking home because daddy wants the endorphins and also it's good for us. And so we walked along the water about 3.5 miles home. And that was perfect. About an hour to do it, gave me the hit I needed, gave me the dopamine. It was a great exercise for her. And so, you find those ways to do it. So yes, there are rules that I live by, but those rules can be slightly altered when need be. It's not going to be a rule where I don't exercise. That's very rare. But, an hour on the bike or an hour walking with my kid in the sunshine, you can make it work.
I had an aha moment doing research for this interview literally today. I came across a video, you're talking about eliminating unnecessary decisions, and you described your closet. And I was like, why have I never done this? You have effectively like formal and informal sections of your closet. One side is sort of day to day. And the other side is you're given a workshop, you're going to be on TV. Oh my God, that's brilliant.
Yeah, 100%. I have. They're literally labeled. One side says office slash travel. The other side says speaking slash TV, and they are designed so I don't have to think about it. Because if I have to think about it, I will figure out a reason. Oh, that sweater. Oh God, I remember that sweater. Laura gave me that sweater. I wonder how she's doing. I should look her up. It's 3 hours later. I'm naked in the living room on Facebook, and I haven't left the house. You eliminate the choice and the potential of going down a rabbit hole by preventing that in advance. It doesn't mean I don't have style. I mean, I have to go to an event tonight, and so I'll go into my daughter's room where I have my suits and my vests and my dad. It's all about eliminating the negatives while enhancing your life as the positive.
That brief story about the sweater and reminding you of your friend and what's she up to, that's an important insight because I think a lot of we ADHD folks do that without knowing that we're doing it, right? I think we're in the middle of a transition. We hit that hallway in between the first activity and the second activity, and something kind of grabs us and it sends us down this memory rabbit hole or curiosity rabbit hole, and we don't even necessarily catch it. We're just like, oh, I don't know, it's been 10 minutes and I haven't done the thing I was supposed to do next, and I'm not sure why.
Exactly.
So being on guard and potentially wondering, like, what was I drifting off into at that time might help us determine where those unnecessary choices are and how we might be able to rein them in a little bit.
100%.
You mentioned traveling with your daughter. And that's something I'm really curious about because you travel a lot. And I'd love to play in that area a little bit. One around sort of how do you navigate travel because it can be so disruptive for folks with ADHD. Maybe you just do it enough that it's not disruptive anymore. And then I'm also curious now that you've added your daughter into that part of your life. So either direction, either just traveling in general or specifically, what is it like to travel with your daughter? What are you getting out of that? How does your ADHD play a role in that, and her childhood and being a kid.
I'm well aware of my gifts and limitations. When I'm on a plane, I am focused. I flew back from Rome yesterday and got more work done in those 9 hours than I have all week, the previous week. And the reason for that is because I know exactly I can't walk, I can't leave, I can't go anywhere. I'm on that plane. That is my brain saying, okay, it's time to focus. Put on some good music, put on my headphones, and just go to town. When I'm with my daughter, she gets that. We're going to Paris next month to see it's her birthday gift. We're seeing Taylor Swift. And we're going to see Taylor Swift next month to Paris. And she knows that it's a red eye flight on the way down, so we're going to sleep. And on the way back, it's a Monday, daddy's going to work. And so she has her movies. She has her Spanish homework. She has her math homework, whatever she has to do for school. It'll be on the computer. We'll get her online. And she understands the benefits of that. Now, when I travel with her and I'm working, I build in. So when we were in Athens, I had a keynote and I built in an extra day. So we did a tour. We did a private tour, took all around the Parthenon and the Acropolis and all that. And it's funny because at one point she goes, Daddy, we did that one day of touring, but we were there for 2 other days and didn't really do a lot. I'm like, right, that's what business travel is. And she's like, oh, I'm like, yeah, you kind of thought it was like when you go to Mexico with grandma and grandpa and you're at a water slide park all week. It doesn't work like that. I said, so when daddy travels a week and you get jealous, I said, it's not that much to get jealous about. It doesn't mean they're not fun, but you know, you're learning something different here. So the goal for me is to make sure that every time I travel with her, that she gets a learning experience out of it. For me, like I said, my happy place is on a plane. It's where I'm most productive. So the more I can be on a plane, the better.
I love the story from Faster Than Normal about how you wrote the book on the plane and then got snagged by customs because they were like, I forget where you flew to. Was it Singapore? You flew to a country in Asia and then back in like a day.
Tokyo.
Got there, turned around and came back. And they were like, clearly you're a smuggler. Such a chuckle. That story is awesome. And I also understand the lens of like getting work done on a plane. I've designed some of my best workshops on a plane.
I mean, you're there, you're focused.
For those of us who, you know, can't just hop on a plane and fly to Tokyo to do our work, what are some alternatives? Like, what do you do if a plane's not happening? Are you just locking your office door?
No, it's not
are
even
you
the
going
office.
Somewhere
Usually
else?
The office doesn't work. Usually I'll take my laptop and I'll go find a place. If it's nice outside, I'll go sit in Central Park or, you know, under a tree or something like that. Or I'll even go, sometimes I go to someone else's office. It's amazing how much more productive you are when you're outside of your own element. So I'll call a friend or, you know, my girlfriend lives in New Jersey. I'll go to her place and say, hey, I'm going to borrow your kitchen table for a couple hours, right? Or I've gone to a Costco and sat in the $1.50 hot dog section with my laptop. I've gotten work done because when you're in, like right now I'm in my office and I'm looking around at this great view. There's my dog, he's sleeping. My daughter's in her room because they have the week off for spring break, because of course they do. And you know, there are a lot of distractions here. In Costco, you'd think there'd be more distractions, but there's something about being at the table, the headphones on, just working. I don't see anything else. It's literally like wearing blinders. And that's an amazing thing. Same thing on an airplane, same thing in Central Park or forest or whatever. Someone took a great photo of me once standing outside the DC Metro with my laptop on a ledge. And I was just working because I had an hour to kill, standing up, typing and getting work done. And it's amazing how beneficial it can be to get out of your own element, right? If you're constantly in your office, oh, I should clean that up. I should look at that. Oh, the dog's peeing. Oh, whatever. You know, to be somewhere else, I think the key is whatever goes on around you when you're not in your home or your office, shut up. Whatever goes on when you're not in your home or your office has nothing to do with you. Waffle. Right now, I get a dog barking. If I wasn't on this call, I'd probably go see what he's barking at. Is there someone at the door or whatever? Probably just the next door neighbor, but we'd check anyway, and that would take me out of my zone of focus. The person next to me having a hot dog at Costco is not my problem. The runners going around the loop in Central Park, 20 feet from me as I'm on my computer under a tree, is not my problem. That's really the key, is that you eliminate all of those distractions, because those distractions don't bother you anymore.
And this also goes back to that sweater example, right? Because not only are those things not your problem, you don't have any memory associations with those things or emotional associations with those things that are likely to derail you. So you can stay focused on Costco despite the noise and the energy and the chaos of people buying things.
100%.
Because there's nothing there to drag you out. I just redid my office and I don't have any associations in here anymore because everything is different. And I'm wondering how long it's going to take for that to fade. But my office is a really effective place for me to be at the moment because all of the space is different. And it's just a new room, despite being a room that's been in my house since we moved in 15 years ago. When it comes to kind of being a dad and having a daughter, is that what led you to write The Boy with the Faster Brain? Is that what kind of got you interested in supporting kids? Was it just a natural progression of, I'm already talking to people, kids are people too. What's the genesis of that book?
The genesis of that book is that I never want any child to experience the crap that I went through growing up. In the 70s and 80s in the New York City public school system, ADHD didn't exist. What existed was, Peter, sit down, you're disrupting the class. That was common. That was every day. That was a note home from school 3 days a week, 4 days a week, 5 days a week. And it was promises every night. I promise I'll try and do better. I'll try and do better. I was never doing that. When I was finally diagnosed in my late 30s, early 40s, everything made sense. It's like, of course, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I totally get why I have what I have and why I am the way I am. By that time, I'd figured out how to use it to my advantage. But growing up, all I knew is I was different and different is wrong. When you're a kid, your job is to fit in and make friends. And I was the exact opposite of that. And it sucked, man. It was terrible. It was horrible. I wanted to write this book. First of all, everyone told me after Fast and Normal came out to write a kid's book. And, so in classic ADHD fashion, I waited 5 years, and then wrote a kid's book. When I wrote it, it just shot to the top of the charts and everyone was buying it. And I started getting invites to speak to all these schools. I was at a school in New Jersey a couple months ago, and this kid comes up to me afterwards. He's been really quiet, sitting in the back the whole time. He comes out afterwards and has tears in his eyes and he goes, "Can I give you a hug?" I'm like, "Oh, absolutely, yeah." He's like, "I never met anyone who said it was okay to be me before."
Wow.
And just in third grade, right? Just lost my shit. It was amazing. So that's why I wrote the book, right? Because as society, we're on the very, very beginning of this precipice to understand that different is good and that normal is boring and that you can do anything. Report by the RAND Corporation, neurodiversity and national security, how to tackle national security challenge with a wider range of cognitive talents. And basically, what it says is that if the government does not start including the neurodiverse in national security, they're going to fall behind. There are countries out there that have entire divisions of their national security and their intelligence services that are neurodiverse specifically because they see patterns better than the people. They see different things, and so we don't do that here. And if you work for the government, you have any sort of security clearance above basic, from advanced all the way to top secret or eyes only, and you want a pair of noise canceling headphones, you're actually required to go see a psychiatrist that the government gives you. And they have to diagnose you as severely disabled to grab a pair of noise canceling headphones for the office. Who the hell wants that on their record? So no one says anything,
Yep.
right? That needs to change.
I had a friend who wanted to work in some significant government agencies. I don't know how detailed I can be on this. And they didn't want to do anything to connect them to mental health stuff in any way, shape, or form, because to realize their dream, they needed to not do that. And that's stunning to me.
It's really crazy. I mean, it's not like you're a pilot who's telling people that, you have 20/30 vision when you're supposed to have 20/20. It's something completely more than that. It's something that can be beneficial.
Yeah.
If you understand what it is and how to do it, there's less downsides and tremendous upsides. And yeah, we don't see that.
They wouldn't even go to the guidance counselor. Like they hit a rough patch in eighth grade, and I was like, go talk to the guidance counselor. Nope, didn't want to do it. And I'm using they on purpose to try to
I get
evenize
it.
the gender,
Yeah.
because I don't know how much that who listens to podcasts. I don't want to get my friend in trouble.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything going on. There's no
Right,
like
of
mental health
course.
stuff going at all, but they were being careful. I want to talk about the book a little bit more, because sort of as a former English teacher, as a guy who likes children's literature, it's really good. It's very much it's a, like you'd think for a kid's book. It's pretty straightforward in terms of how it's written, but there's a couple of points that really landed well for me, and like it's about a kid who has ADHD and is getting support for that, right? It starts with the kid gets in trouble, and then from there we get support. It's written for kids, so this is a way to help your kid feel seen, like Peter already mentioned. The two parts that landed most significantly for me was when the dad comes in after he gets home from work, right? The kid note from home from school, and mom's like, "All right, we're going to talk about this when dad gets home." The kid hears the dad come in, and there's all this anxiety that he's experiencing. I'm going to get in so much trouble. And then you immediately pivot. Why did you make that choice? Because you were setting it up like dad's going to be upset, and then you immediately pivot and dad's like, "Hey kid, I get it."
Because I remember coming home from school and being in trouble from, getting a note sent home. I wasn't paying attention, or I was cracking the class up, or I wasn't, it was disruptive. And my parents tried, they punished me, sure. I mean, I was grounded half my education, but I also remember they always asked questions and they always tried to get to the root of why, right? Why could I promise that I wouldn't do it and kept doing it? What was causing that? What in my head was causing me to forget that I'd said I wouldn't, and why did I go? And so I tried to model it both on what my parents did and what I do with Jessa when she comes home and she's had a bad day or whatever. We try to talk about it. And it's not a punishment. I want to know what caused it. What can we do to make sure it doesn't happen again? What can we do to fix it? If you punish someone for doing something wrong, then there's certainly valid reasons for that. I mean, Jessa was, 2 years old, whatever. The cat was in her way. She pushed the cat, and you got punished for that because you don't push a cat. You don't push animals. You don't hurt her. And she learned a lesson. That's a viable punishment opportunity. But getting in trouble because you're talking in class because you literally don't know how to stay calm, or because you're trying to. I mean, in my case, every day I got sent home was because I got in trouble, got a note sent home was because I made a joke and the teacher would say something, I'd crack the class up. When that class left, I got a dopamine hit. And this was dopamine that my body wasn't creating to begin with. So I was, what does dopamine help you do? It helps you sit down and focus. I was technically trying to learn. I didn't realize at the time why I was doing it, neither my parents, but I was trying to learn. And so that was how I knew when the class left, I felt good and could sit and focus. Problem was, every time the class left, I would have to spend the rest of the class in the principal's office. So I never got the opportunity, but I knew what I was trying to do. So my goal with the book, and also with how I raised my daughter, is let's understand first where this is coming from. This is not, you know, you bullied someone for their lunch money because you wanted to or you could. This is, you know, what's going on and why.
I am that pivot, right? Like, that's part of why it resonated with me so much, is I was not that different from you growing up. I didn't get in trouble as much as you, I don't think. My issues were more, you're not doing your homework, you're not turning things in on time. Like, that's where I was getting in trouble. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as much mm-hmm. behavioral. But my kids, like, I got in trouble a lot for not doing my homework. And there was not a lot of, like, let's figure out why. It was mostly do your homework. And I'm like, okay, I don't know how to do that, but sure, I guess I'll figure it out someday. And with my kids, I try to make that pivot. Eighth grade, Gavin was rocking it. He was doing amazing. And then third term, he tanked. He just dropped the ball, tanked it. And we said to him, like, we go through the report cards like you do. And we're like, all right, what do you think? Like, do we need to do anything differently? Because Nate has struggled on and off. Nate's had tutors and things, and that we haven't had to do that with Gavin. I'm like, so we're basically saying, do we need to go tutor? What's up? And he went, no, I think I just needed to see that and I'll fix it. And we're like, okay. And sure enough, he did. Plenty of parents out there, even a kid that's rocking it consistently and then tanks it, that kid's going to have some significant consequences. There's going to be parents feeling anxious about this pivot and sharing that anxiety with their kids in a way that is not helpful, through anger, through frustration, through something that's not great. And sometimes you can just say, all right, what do you think? And move on. So I loved the pivot. It's one of my favorite parts of the book. It also brought to mind, this is going to be a weird ADHD tangent, but I think it might be interesting. My boys and I recently are going through the Rocky movies sort of once a month or so. Mm-hmm. And we got to Rocky V. There's a scene in Rocky V that is one of the greatest moments in parenting that I've ever seen on film, which you wouldn't think would happen in Rocky V. But the whole movie is about him sort of ignoring his kids so he can train this new boxer, right? And he figures out that he's doing it wrong eventually. Like, the boxer abandons him and he realizes he's damaged his relationship with his kid and all this stuff. And he goes to find his kid. And his kid's standing on the street corner with his teen hoodlum friends that he's picked up. And he's smoking a cigarette. And Rocky comes up to him and goes, like, he's talking to him. And he goes, oh, geez, you smoke now too? And the kid's like, yeah, what about it? And he's like, nothing. And Rocky goes back to apologizing to his kid. He sticks with the problem. What's great about that is so many parents, when they have to talk to their kid about something hard and the kid engages in a behavior that they disapprove of, they let themselves get distracted. It's usually swearing that the kid does. The kid drops an F-bomb or something. And now the whole conversation is about that swear instead of whatever we're trying to talk about. So it was awesome to watch Rocky, sort of all people, handle this, what could be a distraction, and not get distracted by it. That story brings me to another question that I think is probably a big one for some listeners. You have been a non-smoker for 9 years now. You quit smoking a little over 9 years ago, and you haven't had a cigarette since. How'd you do it?
I decided I didn't want to smoke anymore, and I downloaded an app that counts the number of days you've quit. Seeing that app, it was on my home screen for like 5 years. Seeing that app every single day, the higher the numbers got, the more pissed I'd be at myself if I started again. And also knowing myself, I know well, damn well, that if I ever have a cigarette again, it won't be just one cigarette. And that'll be it. I'll be smoking until I die. The line I use, and I've said it many times before, is that I have two speeds. Most people with neurodiversity have two speeds. I have namaste, and I'll cut a bitch. There's no middle ground. So I either never have a cigarette again, or I'm a smoker. I quit drinking for several years, and I had a drink a few years ago. That's fine. I didn't like go out and, you know, pillage a village or whatever, but having had a drink, it makes it a lot easier to have another drink another time. And so I decided to put rules into place about that. I don't go out and drink, right? If I have a drink, it's planned in advance. It's with a specific person. It's in my apartment or her apartment, you know, her apartment. It's not a spur of the moment thing, because spur of the moment things for people like us in that situation rarely end well. Spur of the moment things like, hey, we should start a company, usually can end very well. But, you know, it was like during COVID, a keynote in Asia used to take 3.5 days. I'd leave on a Tuesday, I'd get there Wednesday night, I'd speak Thursday morning, I'd fly home Thursday afternoon with the time change, I'd get home Thursday night. So this is a zombie.
Yeah.
But, you know, we miss my kid for a night. Now a keynote in Asia, during COVID, a keynote in Asia took a 45-minute keynote in Asia took 45 minutes, because I'd get up at, you know, 3 a.m. my time, or 9 p.m. my time on a Wednesday would be 9 a.m. Thursday in Tokyo. I'd give the keynote and I'd be done by like 10 p.m. And then I'd have the entire rest of the week. Like, huh. Okay, I don't have to travel. That was my only keynote this week. I could start another company. I could try meth. You know, it's like leftover time, free time, unexpected free time for someone, people like us, is just very, very dangerous. And so I had to put into place situations, rules that would prevent me from having that leftover time that could get me in trouble.
And there's skydiving for you as well, which you can...
Skydiving helps, but, you know, living in New York City, kind of hard to do in the winter.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. One last piece on the book that I think I'm trying to give you some hope in this one more than in anything else. A good framing device. The boy gets a letter from the teacher to start the book. That's not great. So at the end of the book, he gets a letter that's like, hey, your kid's doing a good job. That actually happens because I've done that as a teacher. I taught sixth grade. And one of the things I would say to my sixth grade students, because most of the places I taught, it was the first year of middle school. And I would say to them, look, here's the deal. We don't know who you are. So if you were the kid that got in trouble all through elementary school, we don't know that. And you can make the decision right now to not be that kid anymore if you want to. And it might be hard to do and you might need some help, but you can make that call. This one kid came up to me at the end of the day and was like, Mr. Mahan, I was that kid and I'm not going to be that kid. And I was like, dope. Awesome. And he wasn't. He was amazing. And so a week and a half into school, I was like, I brought him up to my class, my desk at the end of class. I'm like, come here. I wrote a note to your mom about how great you're doing. This is what I want you to do. I'm going to put it in an envelope and I want you to act like you're nervous when you give it to her so that when she opens it, she's thinking you're in trouble and instead she's going to see how great you're doing and it's going to flip her. By coincidence, when I left that day, I drove by him and his mom and she like comes running into the street waving me down.
That's awesome.
And I pull over and she's crying. It was it's one of the best moments of me as a teacher. So that's a real thing. Like there are teachers doing that.
Yeah, it's a, you know, because of all the times that I came home with the bad news, on the times that I did have the good news, I remember having a math test. And for some reason, I think it was because it was word problems. And word problems for me made perfect sense. Mm-hmm. Word problems, maybe because I love reading, whatever, they made perfect sense. And I remember I had failing math at junior high and I aced the test with like a 95 or something like that. And I came home and I was like, how'd you do? I'm like, you know, I thought I studied. And she's like, oh, Peter. I'm like, I guess that's why I got a 95. You know, it's a great feeling. Was that, you know, when your parents are so used to you coming home and saying, yeah, I blew it again. It's a nice feeling when they come home and they see that, you know, you actually did something the right way.
And speaking of the right way, you've got the faster brain concept is sort of the Peter Shankman turn of phrase. I was watching an interview and I don't know how I missed this up until now, but you talked about how having a faster brain is like getting a fast car. And if you buy a fast car, you have to learn how to drive that or you're going to get into a wreck because they handle differently. And that metaphor, I think, is brilliant for the ADHD brain. We have to know how to use our brains to their best capacity.
Well, I mean, it makes perfect sense. We're taught on Hondas. We're taught on little Honda Accords, which is a perfectly fine car. But our brains work much faster than a Honda Accord. And so if we're sitting there, you know, if you floor a Honda Accord, you'll get up to highway speed, which is great if you're turning on the highway. If you floor a Lamborghini, you have to highway speed much, much sooner. Next thing you know, you're 3 miles down the road. You better know how to drive that car. And so for me, that was always the key, was making sure that I knew, you know, once I got older and realized, okay, you're going to talk really, really, when you come home, your ex, now ex-wife, your wife is going to be there and you had a really great day and you want to share that, but you have to learn not to do it immediately. You have to learn to let her say hi, ask her about her day. There'll be time for you to talk about yours. And that to me was this really hard lesson to learn because it was very easy to go in and be, you know, and it didn't matter what she was doing. So of course, if she's there, you know, yeah, had a really crappy day. Why would you not ask about me or, you know, telling me how great everything was and just being so blah, 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 is not what I want right now. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that was a lesson I had to learn. And I did learn. And I've implemented it both with my current girlfriend, with my daughter. It's about making sure, you know, take a breath before you walk in the door. Breathe 5 times before you walk in the door. that'll teach you and it'll give you the pause you need to separate work from home. And then over the course of the night, they'll ask you about your job and ask you about your day and ask you about whatever. And then you can share the good news. But it doesn't have to be automatic.
And just being mindful of time, do you have any ending essentials that you'd like to share with our audience?
Einstein once said that every animal has its own unique talents. But if you judge a fish on its ability to climb a tree, you'll be sorely disappointed. Growing up the way I did, it was very much about, you know, in the public schools, do this the way everyone else does. Very much about if you're different, that's wrong. And over time, I realized that different can be amazing. So one of the first things I taught my daughter was that weird is simply a side effect of awesome. You need to try to become okay with the fact that you might be weird, because it means you're doing something different. If people call you weird, if people look at you differently, it means you're shaking up the status quo. Haters hate change. And so if you have haters, if you have people that, you know, whether those haters are like online or in person, whatever, if you have haters, they're telling you that they're afraid of the changes you're making. And that means you're doing something right.
Hey, you're still here. Nice. Thanks for staying focused all the way through. If you have any thoughts or questions about today's episode, feel free to email me at brendan@adhdessentials.com. And don't forget to check out the website, adhdessentials.com, and visit our Facebook community. I'm looking forward to talking to you again next week. In the meantime, keep focusing on improvement over perfection. 10% better is all you need.